Good afternoon and welcome to this week's edition of Two Men in the Middle, where two men in the Midwest pontificate and expand upon news and current events. I'm Brandon Kinnig.
And I'm Craig Huey.
So, Craig, we want to start off with talking about the ramifications of what's been happening in Afghanistan. We had that horrific terrorist attack that killed 13 Marines, injured many others, killed, I think it's over 100 Afghan civilians, maybe 128 in that range. And what our reaction to that has been, and then where we stand now, with just really a couple days left before that August 31st deadline for complete withdrawal from the country.
So, you know, this week we all learned about ISIS-K. I mean, ISIS-K is, again, some
subsidiary
offshoot of ISIS. I'm not sure what the ideological differences between ISIS and ISIS-K are.
I don't think there's many. Why can't we just call it ISIS? Like, the subsidiaries are the same thing, and it gets too confusing if we're going to have ISIS-K and we're going to start denoting each sect of ISIS by where they're located, because that's just too much.
I think what happened Thursday drove home the point that people have been making. Why is the American military dependent on the Taliban to provide security for the withdrawal of civilians from Afghanistan?
Right.
I think this was the scenario that everybody feared, because I believe what happened is somebody strapped some plastic explosives on themselves, simply waded into this crowd, waited till they got to the checkpoint where they were next to be frisked by American soldiers, and detonated a bomb.
Yep.
There's just not a lot. Again, we're not security experts, but that's something very, very difficult to stop if somebody is absolutely determined to commit a suicide bombing.
Well, and that's why we've been in such a precarious situation from the time that the evacuations began, because we've been relying upon the Taliban to provide security, to ensure that we're able to get our people out safely without any issues. And so we have no leverage here. The Taliban has all the leverage.
And isn't that the main criticism of Biden in this whole process, that we withdrew the American military? This happened under Trump. It continued under Biden. We got down to such a small force of around 2,500 that, number one, we couldn't hold the air base there, Bagram. We couldn't hold it to evacuate, and we're not holding it afterwards. When we leave, that air base is gone.
Completely, yeah. And everything that we leave behind is left in the hands of the Taliban.
So we withdrew our troops down. We released these ISIS-K fighters. These were part of the 5,000 folks that we left out of prison when we abandoned the Bagram air base. And by that point, by default, we were completely dependent upon the Taliban to provide security during our exit. I think that is a legitimate criticism of the Biden withdrawal from Afghanistan.
Yeah, our strategy seems backwards.
But at the same time, I don't know what other options were on the table, but this one seems to be like, this is the point where you can focus on and say, there was a different order of operations. We could have done this.
Oh, yeah.
That may have avoided what happened on Thursday.
And that different order of operations, which, again, this would have started under Trump, is that rather than beginning by immediately withdrawing our military presence, we instead would have ramped up evacuations of civilians and those who worked with us, American civilians as well as Afghan allies, and done a concerted effort to get those people out of the country first and be able to, that way we could rely on our own military might as protection. And instead we did the opposite. And this also goes back to the fact that we had thousands of Afghan visas that were just basically on hold that had not been addressed. And with that backlog also created all kinds of issues, because now our State Department is trying to verify who should be let into the country, who isn't. There's a lack of record keeping. So this dates back to a lot of poor records management as well. And one thing I found interesting, that not only did we apparently over the past 20 years not keep good records at all on the Afghans who assisted us, the records we did have, many of those were at the U.S. Embassy in Kabul. And when the embassy was evacuated, they destroyed all the records because they didn't want to leave them behind, naturally. But then that means that there's no records now in many cases.
And that gets to the second point of Biden putting out what is in many ways an arbitrary deadline, that in order to meet that deadline, we are completely dependent upon the Taliban. I think we have done some out of the airport missions to go get people. But for the most part, what our position has been, draw down your troops, harden the inside of the Kabul airport as best you can, and then rely on the Taliban to provide security outside that allows people to come to the airport for to be evacuated. So what I'm struggling with is, just on raw numbers, we seem to have gotten a lot of people out of Afghanistan.
We have.
The last time I saw it, it was about 115,000.
Especially in the last week. It really ramped up, where we were doing several thousand a day, in some cases 8,000-9,000 a day.
Well, and at one point, I think we did like 15 or 20 when we, you know,
yeah, we had
a couple
one day
of days
where we did
really, really got people in there. So just on sheer volume, on sheer number, we've been able to get a lot of people out of the country. Well, we don't really have a clear picture of is who are these people?
Yeah.
How many of these people were interpreters? How many of these people were American citizens? How many of these people provided direct aid and assistance to the United States military? So while that number is big, the peeling back that we're going to have to do over the next couple weeks, once Tuesday gets here and we end, is of the people that we got out, the volume was high, but was the quality there?
Yeah.
Were they the right people?
This process is happening amidst a lot of chaos, and it makes it very difficult to be able to verify who's who when, you know, you have all this chaos erupting around you. And then the Biden administration, too. So they have this hard and fast August 31st deadline, but then the administration has also been a little bit ambiguous about that. At times they've said, well, we might go beyond that.
Have you heard why? What was it about?
I don't know why. Yeah, I don't. So if you go back, originally the Biden administration set a deadline of September 11th, but due to the optics of that, they then,
which was dumb to begin with.
Exactly. Why? So then they took it back to August 31st. But again, I think this has been self-defeating, has really limited what we're able to do. But because having that deadline, that's also a deadline that the terrorists are aware of, as well as the Taliban and ISIS. And it allows them to really provoke us and really test our mettle up to that deadline. And they've been doing that. So not only that terrorist attack, but as of today, there was a second terrorist attack that was likely going to happen. U.S. military via drone took out a car bomb full of terrorists, thankfully, that was headed towards the airport. So that was likely going to be a second terrorist attack.
And we've droned the ISIS-K leadership or the planners of that.
So there's been several good wins in the aftermath of the terrorist attack that happened last week. So that is positive. But it also, again, just points to how bad the security situation is, and the fact that the Taliban does not have a complete control on the ground of what's going on.
So I'm sitting here, as you went through that timeline, I just realized that how a series of random decisions have put us in the spot we're in. September 11th was chosen. That's not a random date, but that's a date with some significance to us, that somebody thought for some reason it would be important or significant to pull out or complete the pullout on that day. That was a bad decision. So then somebody said, okay, we can't do it then. What are we going to do? Are you going to push it back? Well, if we're there past September 11th, that loses all of the power of the original September 11th date.
Yeah.
So they just said, we'll pull out by August 31st.
But see, that's why it's so asinine to be doing this publicly, right? Why not just have a date in the back of your mind, but publicly say, we're pulling out in 2021. This is the year we're pulling out. No more detail than that. And then that gives us the ability to do that gradual drawdown, ensure that we have a process to get everybody out. We're not scrambling with just a few days left. And thankfully, we have been able to get more people out, and there hasn't been more casualties. But this could have been much more worse than it was. I mean, if you really think about the events of the past 2 weeks, like, it could have been much worse, and thankfully it wasn't.
Brendan, I just ran this sentence through my head, and you tell me if this sounds completely insane when I say it, that our withdrawal from Afghanistan reflects the largest, most successful attempt to extract people from a country that we are leaving after we've been at war in United States history.
I think that's right, based on volume alone. I mean, because again, I think if you go back to Syria, that conflict,
we just left that
in 2019. Yeah. We just left there. We left the Kurds to fend for themselves. Did not do anything to protect our allies in that situation. And Vietnam,
it was
when Saigon fell, a couple thousand. Yeah, I mean, we left a lot of people behind in that conflict as well.
And this also sounds a little bit goofy saying, if you take the totality of what has happened in Afghanistan, I generally, in most part, agree with how Biden went about this. There are some things that I think could have been done differently. But for the most part, with the situation that he found and what was handed to him, I think he did about as good with it as he could. Now, there's a couple of things in that. There's a couple of factors that I'm putting into the hopper here that need to hold true for this to be, for that statement to be accurate. Number one, why didn't we all do this out of Bagram, our own air base? That seems to be like the most logical thing to do. What I've heard is that Bagram is about 40 miles outside of Kabul. And the problem was, is that you open up a 40 mile kill zone. So picture 115,000 people that we've gotten out. So let's say 200,000 people be getting a caravan 40 miles outside of Kabul to the Bagram air base. How many thousands of men would have taken to protect that caravan? And if I'm ISIS K or ISIS L or Y or whomever, that would represent the opportunity to do the most amount of damage. I accept at least the logic of that explanation.
Yeah.
And if you do, therefore, the only alternative was the Kabul airport. There was no other way you were going to get this done. And with only 2,500 folks in the 2,500 troops on the ground and the releasing of thousands of Taliban prisoners, you had to expect something like this was going to happen.
And that's a fair argument to be made. I think I'm probably stronger in my criticism of the Biden administration on other facets of this entire withdrawal process, mainly the processing of visas. Like, it just seems like this wasn't a priority for the administration when they came into office. There were many members of Congress who said they asked about the backlog. They asked about what we were doing. They got no response. Or, you know, they
I was
just
told that when Stephen Miller left, this would all improve. It didn't seem like it has.
Yeah, it just seems like it just wasn't touched. It was just one of those things that the administration decided they were going to get to it at some point down the line. And they were caught off guard, which I think many people were, by how quickly the Taliban took ground. So there was a lot riding on this assumption that we could do so much in the very late stages, because it was all based on this assumption that turned out to be false, that the Taliban wasn't going to have control of the entire country, which of course isn't what happened. So it all goes back to how wrong everybody was when it came to the speed and the agility at which the Taliban was able to overtake the Afghan government.
And I heard that when the Taliban let the prisoners out of Bagram, they lined up eight of the ISIS-K leadership and immediately executed them. I mean, Taliban and ISIS-K, like many other factions in Afghanistan, they don't get along at all.
Right.
And the first thing that's going to happen as soon as we leave on Tuesday, the Afghan civil war begins.
There's a new civil war, just like what happened in the late 80s and early 90s. Yeah.
We go right back to late 80s, where now there's tons of factions that have been released from prison. There have been people that have been reunited with fighters that they haven't had access to, that have either been imprisoned or in foreign countries. It feels like for the next 2 to 3 years, it's just an all internal war to figure out, does the Taliban hold on or does one of these factions actually take over, or how much power can one of these gain too? I also read that the first decision the Taliban has to make is how big of drug dealers do they want to be?
Yeah.
Because most of the opium, I believe, is raised in Afghanistan.
Right.
And it's a tribe that does it. So the Taliban, the first decision is, what agreement are they making with the opium growers?
Well, they were pretty heavily involved back in like 96 and so when they took power the first time,
right?
It's
probably one of the few streams of revenue they're going to have. So,
and that's one of the things they're going to have to grapple with. And the other aspect of this, the people that we are getting out, the Afghan allies and those that are able to leave, it's a massive brain drain. Many of these people are doctors, lawyers, educated people. And so, and the Taliban is aware of this. And so they've been trying to guilt a lot of these people into staying. But of course, if you have the means and you're able to get out, like, you're going to get out. You're not going to stay. But it's going to have immense ramifications for the lack of human capital in the country going forward. Because they're not going to have enough people in these various industries and professions, and that's going to have a ripple impact. So that's going to impact their economy. They don't really have an economy after this either. So you're right. I mean, they're really left with, I mean, like opium and drugs, and how far they're going to go with that.
Opium and terrorism are the two underpinnings of the Taliban's economy. And it feels like they're going to have to get right back to it to eke out some sort of existence. While I'm willing to cut the Biden administration more slack than you are, I still, like you, have severe problems with some of the stuff that they've done. I agree. They got handed a giant shit sandwich, but there were two or three turns that they simply didn't make it better on themselves. And any criticism that they get out of this is well deserved and should be heaped upon them at this point.
And part of the problem was, I mean, even the Secretary of State, Tony Blinken, just a couple days before Kabul fell, was messaging that, you know, the Afghan government was still intact. They were strong. It was, they weren't going to fall. And it was mere days later that they fell. So clearly there was an inability to see this coming and there was an inability to prepare for it. And then when it happened, there was a huge messaging gap and a huge messaging problem. Yeah. And again, I don't know why presidents do this, but it does you no good to shut yourself off, to just kind of go underground in the bunker mentality. You need to get out there immediately. You need to message. You need to say, okay, this is where we're wrong. This is what we're going to do now. Because the longer you don't do that, you allow a different narrative to form. And that narrative is usually on incompetence, dysfunction, and you don't want that to happen. And that's also an area where I, you know, think that they did not do well, because that's, again, something I would have expected the former administration, which they did. And then, again, there was not a lot of coordination with our European allies. They were very kind of pissed throughout this process and how it transpired. So all around, there was communication gaps that were not addressed.
Do you think it's fair to say that how this was communicated, you talked about the lack of communication with our allies, that this, the communication of this felt very Trumpian.
Yeah.
You could see the Trump administration doing this, cutting our allies out for 36 hours where we just give them no information. And the explanation to the American people from the Biden administration has been confusing
at best.
Again, why do you not simply know the number of Americans that you're targeting to get out of Afghanistan?
Yeah.
I completely understand that they are not required to register with the embassy, but that wasn't the question asked.
Right.
Then how many do you know?
That doesn't instill confidence. And
yes.
Then when false information is given out, like, oh, you know, they just need to get to the airport, as if it's that easy, or they just need to call our people. Well, no. It's not that easy.
I think that's the phrase that kind of solidifies this, is this, that the casualness sometimes that they went about doing this. Well,
and again,
they just call
front.
It Google Gang.
I think, again, this is a lesson that always needs to be relearned, but be upfront about the challenges, be upfront about, you know, the realism, and say, okay, this is a very difficult situation. We recognize that people can't get to the airport. We're doing everything we can behind the scenes. We have a plan in place. Like, just be upfront about it, but also don't give false assurances or attempt to paint the picture rosier than it is, because that's always going to backfire.
And Biden's inflexibility, his kind of, you know, he has that kind of come on, man.
Yeah.
When he feels like he's, when a question is put to him that he doesn't want to answer.
A little bit of flippant, his kind of flippant attitude is kind of the way it comes
across. And he gets basic, he got some basic stats wrong here too. It's some basic information wrong. Al-Qaeda is in Afghanistan. They've always been in Afghanistan. He said one time, we don't have troops in Syria. We do have troops in Syria. So it's a combination of not giving all of the facts. There's something in sales that we do a lot where you're giving facts, but you're not giving context. And that's what I feel the Biden administration has done.
Yeah.
They feel a little kind of bad salesman-y here, where it's like, of course you have some sort of target. Of course you know. You're just not giving it to me. And instead of saying, I don't want to give you a number that you're going to hold me to later that I could look bad on if we don't hit, you're doing some semantic dance of, well, that number changes every minute. The number that I now would give you would be inaccurate. That to me is something that you expect. That's the type of response you get from somebody that doesn't want to communicate clearly and in good faith with you.
Right.
And the Biden administration they have come off that way a half a dozen times during this whole process.
Yeah. I mean, it's been kind of a tone of annoyance and just, you know, even getting kind of these questions and the fact that this is the hand that they're dealt with.
Yeah.
And part of it too, like, I think there's going to be plenty of time to assign blame, and there's so much blame to be assigned to the prior administration, but now's not the time to do it. Americans just want, what's your plan? How are we going to end this? Ensure the fewest casualties possible, getting as many people out as possible. And then we can go back and, to actually write the narrative on how this happened and why it happened. And the fact that this goes all the way back to, you know, February 2020, when this deal was struck with the Taliban and Qatar.
I have taken a deep dive through conservative media the past 2 weeks again.
Ugh,
exclusively Fox on cable news and listening to folks like Hugh Hewitt and The Dispatch.
Oh, Hugh Hewitt had Trump on. Did you see that?
I listened to the first five and I just couldn't. I couldn't do it. I couldn't pull the whole interview.
I read the transcript of what Trump said, and it is the most ridiculous word salad. I mean, he doesn't even know who the leader of the Taliban is, who he met with. He had to be coached into actually.
I love it when somebody talks about how Biden's completely full of dementia and can't form a sentence and isn't running the country. And then the guy who allegedly is the model of physical and mental health in
right.
your 70s pops on. And I really can't see much of a difference between the two.
Well, and then you read that and you're like, you know, well, thank God. I mean, can you imagine if this guy was in charge? Because he has no idea what's going on. But you're right. I've tried to stay away from conservative media because there's been a couple of points they've been hitting on. One is that they're trying to instill fear that we're having all these Afghan migrants come into the country. They're going to change the face of America. It's like 2015 all over again with the Syrian refugee crisis in Europe, and that's we're ground zero for the Afghan refugee crisis. So there's that aspect. And then there's just the absolute insanity and lunacy of people like Matt Gaetz and others who are giving credibility to the Taliban and just spouting off statements like the Taliban is a more legitimate government than Biden. I mean, just insane stuff like that.
And Hugh Hewitt's interesting because I'm assuming he's in his earlier mid-70s. He's been around forever. One of the things that Hewitt keeps coming back to and conservative media keeps coming back to is this is an attack on our honor. This is personally embarrassing as the United States. You know, Ben Shapiro calls the Taliban. These are 8th century morons, basically, is who they are. And the thought that we are being pushed around and dictated to by the Taliban is just completely not palatable to this group of folks. And they're still running off this kind of America is the white knight. We are always on the right side. We represent American values, which we transplant around the world. And we do that as a positive thing. And they almost see this. What's got them the most fired up is that this is an attack kind of personally on our honor. This is a stain on our military. We don't run. We don't lose. Does that have any impact on you? Because you're mid-30-ish.
Yeah.
I'm in my 50s. There's 15 years that separate us. What I've been trying to think through is for folks that are in their 30s or even under 30, do those concepts still mean anything to
I don't
those
think
folks?
So. I mean, again, it belies a lack of understanding of history, right? Because I think that we saw that mythology start to crumble in the aftermath of the Vietnam War, right? We realized we were not invincible. In the Vietnam War, we had been running this guerrilla warfare campaign against the North Vietnamese for years and had barely been able to move ground, and we withdrew. And I think we realized at that time that there are some of these conflicts we can't win. And if you look at the scale and type of conflicts since Vietnam in the 80s, 90s to 2000s, most of these conflicts have been intractable conflicts where there's been no clear winner or really any side gaining ground. And you don't have to go very far. It's another piece of recent history people seem to forget is 1982, 1983, the Lebanese Civil War. We had a troop presence in Lebanon as part of a NATO peacekeeping efforts during their civil war. There was an incident where we had 241 Marines that were killed in the bombing of the Marine barracks in Lebanon. I mean, talk about destroying our sense of pride and honor. And people forget that Reagan ended up withdrawing all of our troops out of Lebanon. Like, we left Lebanon after that incident. And partially that was because Congress also signed a resolution, which Reagan upheld. But we agreed that, like, we were done. That was a bridge too far, and we weren't going to stay. So, you know, there's been incident after incident where we have been defeated or we've suffered horrible losses, and we have left and we've withdrawn and we've realized that it's time to go. This is the end. We're not going to stay to fight another day.
That's what's so weird. We've withdrawn before. We've pulled out of places before.
Syria, in most recent history. I mean,
in recent history, we've pulled out of places.
Yeah.
If you listen to Fox, you would think this is a historic event that has never happened to the United States military. And us leaving a country that we tried to nation build in, that this is something that there is no parallel anywhere in history. I just don't think that message is if you're over 70, yeah, that probably you gravitate more to that. But I don't think anybody
in the last decade alone, Syria and Iraq, yeah. I mean, two countries that we've left. I mean, we've done this so many times.
We shit on people all the time that we partner with in war. Isn't that in some ways part of war?
Yeah.
It's part of the real crappy part of going to war is you realize we're going to screw some people in Afghanistan and they're going to end up getting killed. And the day we set boots on ground, that was always going to be part of the outcome.
Right.
There's no way around it. And plus this lack of maturity that we have about, you know, that this was not going to be the inevitable outcome. I just don't get that either.
I guess that's what is so frustrating and so misleading, as you have a cadre of conservatives who are claiming that somehow a Taliban takeover of the entire country would not have happened if Trump were president, when that's exactly what he did.
He negotiated
a surrender to the Taliban, locked out the Afghan government, and immediately crippled them and made it so that this was the inevitable outcome.
I've not heard a single person in sane conservative media not say that the deal that the Trump administration signed with the Taliban was one of the worst things they've ever seen. And that this outcome, for the most part, was inevitable the day that was signed.
Well, and yeah, so several have, but there's many that haven't. And that's the problem. There's many that just kind of like brush past it. Like it's not as detrimental as it really was. And then you have this whole segment of people who say, well, yeah, but, you know, Trump had conditions and they had to meet these conditions. And they can't even point to what
they were breaking those conditions while they were signing the 3-page document.
Yeah, and they're saying, well, under Biden, the Taliban has become aggressive. They've always been aggressive. Yeah, they have never not been aggressive. So you can, you know, try to rewrite the narrative all you want, but the fact of the matter is that surrender started last year. The Taliban began retaking provinces in Afghanistan last year. They began negotiating with tribal governments last year. All of this started while Trump was still president, and there was no ramification. There was no consequence for it. We continued with drawing down troops, even as the Taliban began executing people and taking back territory.
And you're right. By the time Biden got involved with this, in many ways, the die was already cast.
Yeah,
that is true. If you don't feel like sending 25,000 troops back into Afghanistan,
right?
Everybody that tells you, well, he didn't have to honor the terms of that agreement. He's thrown every other thing Trump's done away. Why wouldn't he throw this one? That fundamentally is true, but it comes with a surge of troops into Afghanistan.
Kind of, a la President Obama in 2012. Yeah. When we had the troop surge of 100,000 military men and women. And yes, we were able to hold the country and hold the Taliban at bay, but we did not destroy the Taliban.
No.
They just retreated back into their cave network and waited us out as they've done now.
Yeah. I just...
And we can't forget, too, that the Taliban has continued to control pockets of the country since the beginning of this war back in 2002. We have never had a strong centralized Afghan government that has had control of the entire country. That's a facade. Kabul has been in government control. It's the capital. But then once you get into the outlying provinces, it's anything goes. And you have direct Taliban control that's remained, I mean, for the past 10 years.
Well, a percentage of the Afghan government's military had already surrendered to the Taliban since May. They were making their own deals with them. They were surrendering to, because they knew if a fight breaks out, we're probably not going to win.
Right.
And
they knew, you know, they pay attention to what we do as well as a country.
Sure.
And so when Trump signed that deal and undercut the position of the Afghan government. Afghans are watching that, and they're like, okay, well, we see the writing on the wall. Like, why bother at this point?
Somebody made a good point. Do you expect them to stand in an Alamo style to the death fight with the Taliban? Because there's no surrendering.
No.
Once that kicks off, they're going to kill everybody.
And if they're going to do that, remember, they're not just going to kill those people. They're going to come after their families, their wives, their kids. And so it's like, I mean, and if you're a, you know, you expect a 25-year-old kid in many cases to risk all of that.
So the Taliban already, by the time Biden gets, let's just say at the beginning of August, the Taliban already owns the vast majority
of the country.
They've also already negotiated with big swaths of the Afghan government military for surrender or how this is all going to go down.
This was all set in motion.
To your point, it was all done by the time they'd gotten to the Kabul airport.
Right.
Everybody knew. The thing that I don't understand is this is where I thought Biden was really supposed to be good at, and this was his strong suit, just come out and saying, look, guys, this is a massive shit sandwich. I'm not going to lie to you.
And see, he never explained.
He never did.
Like, he never provided that historical context. And so it's left upon like people like me and you to provide that, because it's almost like people have just, you know, I think, you know, erased, you know, the past, you know, decade or so.
And you and I are making a good faith attempt to try to understand this, talk through it, and maybe accidentally get somebody else to think about it.
Right.
Of the media that you've watched, who's making a good faith attempt to walk the American people through what's happening in Afghanistan? Ah, I'm struggling here.
Crickets.
Because everybody's picked this up. This is the narrative. You squeeze it where you want to. If you're an anti-Biden or you don't like his policy, you jumped on it.
They're coming at it from political angles, so nobody's providing the historical subcontext of how we actually arrived here. And so that's the frustration.
I heard somebody say that at least this proves that the Democrats are not a cult. Because a lot of Democrats, both in Congress, and I'm just going to go ahead and throw the most of the media. When we say the Democrats, we can throw the media in with most of that.
They've been very critical. Yeah,
they've been very critical. If Trump,
especially
would have done
many of the members of Congress that are Democrats who have military backgrounds too, have been especially critical.
If Trump would have done what he wanted to do, which was twice, I think he tried to just pull a bug out in Afghanistan.
Oh, Republicans would be in lockstep. There'd be no criticism.
Completely
greatest decision ever. Yada,
the other thing that conservative media has really jumped on is Biden himself, that this is a failure due to Biden's personal weakness,
that he's senile, he's losing it, dementia, all of that.
I don't believe in that, but I do believe, and Hugh Hewitt said this, and I do believe this just out of experience with people Biden's that age. When you get to be 79, which I think Biden turns in November,
right,
you become way more inflexible in your thinking. I don't think my mom listens to podcasts anymore, so I'll pick on my parents, but we all see this with our parents.
Oh, yeah.
The older they get locked into patterns of familiarity and patterns of thinking. And it's not that they don't have the mental capacity to think of anything new. They simply don't want to.
Right.
And I think Biden maybe a time or two kind of fell into that, into that vein.
Yeah.
Hey, I know what I'm doing. I've done this a long time. Anyway, he's said some things that patently weren't true. And there's some times Biden just flat out has been confused and wrong when meeting the press. And you just simply can't do that in these types of situations.
No.
Wouldn't you like to see a nice 51-year-old
woman be president
right now?
Well, and that's the irony, right, is that the Trump-supporting crowd, who is all about Biden being senile, yet they uphold their guy, who's a 74, 75, who's...
He's going to be 78 if he runs again.
So
he repeats the same mistake.
Same issue.
What if the president was, like, in awesome shape and, like, did CrossFit every morning? And I'm sure we'd find a way to shit on them for that's terrible. But at this point,
can we elect a president under 60? Is that possible?
I think we've really got to start considering the constitutional amendment. You've got to be under 65 the day you take the oath.
Agree.
Because where are we going with this? I mean, I've said on the pod, I can't vote for Biden again. I can't vote for an 82-year-old. That's just ridiculous. We've got to find a way to start restricting by age who can run for the most powerful position on the planet.
Absolutely. They have the nuclear codes. Again, there's so much power entrusted to that person, and there's a lot at risk. And you want someone who has a mind that's agile and is adept and able to keep up and process various scenarios.
And I'm not saying old people can't do that. I'm just saying as you get older, and I can say this after I've crossed the 50 barrier, you just don't think about, you don't consider certain things when you're thinking anymore. You've done this so much, or you just know. So you just immediately jump to, and you become way more inflexible in your thinking. And I think Biden certainly has fallen into that trap during all of this.
Right.
Now, so this is our main topic. We've done our time on this. COVID, are we going to talk about that again? Let's talk about something else.
Yeah, I don't know if there's really kind of an update with COVID other than...
It still sucks.
Yeah.
Florida's still a mess. Louisiana, now that Ida, a Cat 5 hurricane with winds over 150 miles an hour, is headed, I guess, right at New Orleans today.
Worst storm since the 1850s, they said. Yeah.
Yeah.
They're saying that parts of Louisiana are going to be uninhabitable for weeks to months to come, which is just a scary proposition.
I've seen some videos on Twitter this morning where it looks like, again, inside people's homes looks like 2 to 3 feet of water. I've heard people say, they've come on and said, hey, once winds get up to like 150 miles an hour, all rescue and stuff is stopped. So if you didn't get out, you're just kind of on your own by now, and you're just going to have to ride it out to the end. But that just feels like something we just don't need right now.
No.
It's a big on mainland USA natural disaster.
Yeah, I mean, it's giving me flashbacks to Hurricane Katrina in 2006.
How much of this do you put to climate change? That hurricanes seem to be coming more frequently. They seem to be coming more intense. When they hit ground, it seems to be like we got a Cat 4, Cat 5 all the time now.
Yeah, I think a substantial number, just because prior to this... that level, hurricanes of Cat 5 or higher, or close to Cat 5, were once in a decade occurrences. And now it's almost every year, like you said, that we have one of those in the season, if not more. And it's not just hurricanes, right? You look at, there was massive flooding in Tennessee last week. There were 23 people killed, some young children that were killed. Like that, those were once in a generation floods. Like parts of Tennessee received 17 inches of water in like 12 hours.
Good Lord.
For some context, here in Kansas City, the most rainfall we've ever received in that time period, you'd have to go back to, I think it was like the late 70s, where there were parts of the plaza that had 8 inches of rain within that same. So 17, I mean, that's just unimaginable. And then the wildfires. I mean, you can't understate the impact of these wildfires that are becoming a regular occurrence. There's massive. There's more of them. I mean, the hundreds of thousands of acres of California that are on fire. And they're saying many of these fires aren't going to go out until the end of the year. Well, so we have three, four months left of these fires raging.
There's counties too saying, even if it were for COVID, we'd have a mask mandate because the air quality is so bad. Because of all the damn fires.
Of the fires, yeah.
I guess we could talk about Gavin Newsom's recall.
Oh, that's right. We haven't really touched upon that in a while. So that's looking like it's going to be very close. There's talk about the president and Kamala Harris going in to stump for him next week.
She was there Thursday, but called it off because of the terror attack.
Well, and that's what I'm thinking. Biden may call it off as well, because he's supposed to be there next weekend, as the latest I've heard, to stump for him.
The ultimate troll is if Larry Elder.
Oh my gosh. All people.
Larry Elder is basically like a black Rush Limbaugh.
Yeah.
He's a conservative talk radio host. He's been in the LA market for like 40, 50
long
years.
Time,
he's got a ton of name recognition. Is he qualified to be the governor? He has no political experience. No. I would say no.
Should we remind our listeners how this process is going to work on the ballot?
Thing.
And the threshold is so low, and that's what has Democrats so scared, because Democrats are really thinking about this. They're not fired up. Republicans are. Yep. So in a normal election, this wouldn't be viable at all. But because this is one of those weird, recall random elections, all it takes is for Democrats to not turn out in numbers they normally would, and for Republicans to turn out in greater numbers than they would, and you have a very different governor. You end up yeah. with a Trumpian governor.
Well, the first question is, should Gavin Newsom be recalled? Yes or no?
Yeah.
If 50% or more than 50% say yes.
50% plus one.
Then the next question is, who should take his place? And isn't there's like 46
And it doesn't
names.
Matter how much of the vote the no. person is. It's just the Correct. Leading person who gets the plurality of the vote becomes governor.
So 49.9% of people voting should say Gavin Newsom should remain the governor. And 25% of people who said that, no, he shouldn't, voted for Larry Elder.
Right.
Larry Elder's your new governor.
See, that's the other problem with this. Gavin Newsom isn't in a head-to-head matchup with any of these people.
He's not.
So, which you might have, again, different results, too, if that was the case. But instead, it's keep Gavin Newsom, yes or no, and then it's vote based on this list. And there are no Democrats on that list. It's only Republicans.
That's a great point. He's not running against anybody.
No.
He's just running against the question, should I keep my job?
Right.
That's a much different scenario than saying it's you or it's this person.
Yeah.
Because you can say, all right, I mean, I might be mad at you, but there's no way. There's no way Larry Elder in right. a straight thing would ever come anywhere near being Gavin Newsom.
And that's why Democrats have to think strategically about this, too, because even if you're a Democrat who's unhappy with Newsom, you don't get a chance to vote for an alternative Democrat. Like, your alternatives are Correct. Only...
There's no progressive that you right. can vote for.
So, again, you need to know that going in so you don't make that mistake. And they're like, oh, wait a second. Like, these are my only options.
And California is the largest state by population. In the United States is the fifth largest economy in the world. And due to some goofy ass rules, well, let's just come out and say it. Because Gavin Newsom decided to go to dinner one night at the French Laundry during the pandemic, yeah. which was a complete douchebag move, Larry Elder might be the governor of California.
Yeah.
I mean, you want to continue that theme of you made a random decision to go to this fancy dinner with these lobbyists. And the end result of that might be Larry Elder with 25% of a vote. That's a subset of people that even said Newsom, he could run the fifth largest economy and the largest state in the United States. That's asinine. It's insane.
And I'm surprised the legislature, which has supermajority Democrat control, hasn't changed this process. I mean, because they could change it. It's statute, yeah. right? So they could change the statute to not allow for a recall or to make the bar much higher than it currently is. Because that's the other thing is that they only have to get signatures that amount to 2% of the state's voters to yeah. initiate a recall.
It's not
like
much.
The bar isn't even high. It's not no. even 10%. It's 2% of the total population.
So basically,
of voters.
Democrats could recall any Republican governor they ever wanted to.
They could, yeah. So they can immediately start the recall process for Larry Elder.
And I think this is what you see now with Biden. You people, and these people aren't serious. They're Madison Cawthorn. Yeah. Madison Cawthorn was do the 25th Amendment to kick Joe yeah. out. I've seen
Lindsey Graham said the same thing, didn't he?
Marjorie Taylor Greene is impeaching. Yeah. And I think this is what happens. This is just all straight up talk track and
performative politics
for Trump because they felt like it was done to him. Now they're going to turn around and try to do that to Biden.
Yeah.
And you're right. It's just all performance, meaningless, and doesn't really do
well. Marjorie
anything.
Taylor Greene had talked about impeaching Biden, I mean, months ago. I mean, for no reason other yeah. than, you know, Trump wasn't in office.
Her and Matt Gaetz are continuing.
They're doing this
still,
tour, this like cross country
Freedom
tour.
Of America tour or whatever. Are you tired yet of all of the tweets and stories about the anti-vaxxer who just died of COVID? It seems like my Twitter feed is
there's
just,
a lot of those.
Just constant.
Well, there was that right wing radio show host who
Caleb,
died.
He just died this morning.
Oh, no, I was talking about the one who died a couple weeks ago. The one out of like, I think, Wisconsin.
Like Fred Valentine.
But yeah, Fred Valentine was the last name.
There's been a whole string of old dudes with weird names and gray hair that look like straight from the 70s when you see their headshot.
Oh, yeah.
Like a DJ that's like, what the hell? And then there was a guy, Caleb, I can't think of his last name. He formed the group of like the COVID tyranny freedom fighters.
Oh, okay.
And he was on a ventilator last night. And I just saw a tweet this morning that he unfortunately passed away. Do you feel any... What do you feel when you see that this person who led a group, formed a group of other people against COVID died basically because they wouldn't take the vaccine?
Well, I don't know. It's hard because I feel like I have like a sympathy deficit now, because I feel like get to that point where, you know, you just are adamant and refusing to acknowledge the science and what you need to do to keep yourself safe and others, it really is hard to feel sympathy for those people that have been involved in the misinformation, disinformation campaigns that have helped, you know, create this monster of where we have almost half of the country who refuses to be vaccinated and believes all these conspiracy theories. I feel sympathy, but it's very slight, and it's, you know, and I hate to say it, but it's coupled with just like, oh, well, there you go. I'm not surprised. It's almost just, it's partial indifference only because it's what you would expect, right? I mean, if you're going to tempt fate for so long, it's fate's going to catch up with you.
I mean, in some ways I have a level of respect for these people because they died for the performance.
Yeah.
I mean, they believed in the performance, which is really all they were doing, so much they gave their life for it. In some ways, I don't know if that's what they intended to do. I don't know if that's the game they were playing, but that was the result.
And you're right. There's so many of these cases. And there was one that was a Republican official from Texas who was on like a city or county commission official. But he was somebody who was involved in the Young Republican National Federation. Yeah. Like he was actually exiting the group as I was entering several years ago. So he was one of these who was like, my freedom, I'm never going to get vaccinated. I think in his late 40s, married with kids, ended up passing from COVID. And there's just so many instances of that. But again, I can't say it's surprising though, right? Because it's, you know, especially many of these people that either are obese or have pre-existing conditions or are most susceptible and they refuse to protect themselves. It's almost like the people now who are like getting that ivermectin, that horse dewormer medication. And our local KU med system said that poison calls are up. There's one out of every three calls now are poison calls like due to this drug.
Mississippi was like 70% last week.
And again, it's hard to feel sorry for these people because these are people that say, well, I'm not going to do what the government tells me. I'm not going to get an untested experimental vaccine. Oh, but you'll put a horse dewormer medication into your body.
Everybody, the DIY thing has gone too far. It's gone too far. Okay.
Remember when people did this with hydrochloroquine?
Yes. And, yeah. That stupid ass Drake fishbowl cleaner or some shit.
They had it inside it. Okay. Yeah.
Doing a DIY project of redoing some furniture or flipping a house or building a deck is one thing. You can watch YouTube videos for that. You could get through it. This is your health. It's not a DIY project. You should in no way be diagnosing yourself or administering. I saw a video. I think it was Milo. Yeah, that Yiannopoulos
or whatever. Is he trying to get coverage?
His latest performance is he was, I think, injecting himself with that stuff. And I heard somebody ask, is this like a cream? Is it a pill? Do you have to give yourself a shot? I mean, think about this. You're willing to inject yourself for the performance more than just going to get the vaccine.
Yeah.
I would love it somehow if all of these men who passed away this week or the past 2 weeks, and it's mostly men because women have way more sense of this than men do. Women don't die on the hill of not going to the doctor.
that men a little bit do. More pragmatism. Guys are a little bit more stubborn.
Correct. If each one of them, if somehow whatever God they believed in could have appeared to them and said, I respect what you're doing. I just want to let you know you're going to die for this. Would they have still done it? If they would have known the outcome that you're going to put on this performance against hearing all this, but in the end result, you're going to sacrifice your life. You are the patriot you think you are. And to prove it, you're going to die. Is that what they were after?
I would think not, because I mean, for most, the vast majority of people, self-preservation is the ultimate instinct, right? I mean, when it comes down to it, if your life is on the line, you are going to do everything you can. It's that fight or flight mode, right? Yeah. To preserve yourself. So I would think not, although I don't know anymore. I just don't.
My guess, and it's just a guess, because when I see some of these dudes, I can identify with them as I get older. You've been on air for 30 years. probably there's a lot of people that don't want you anymore. You've probably gone a little bit past where you're supposed to be in your career, and COVID has been an absolute godsend to you. You completely extended and maybe in some ways resurrected your career, because now you have a topic to talk about on the radio that you didn't have before all of this. And I think some of them might have just got wrapped up in this return to relevancy they've had and just let that get the best of them.
I think that's a good diagnosis of
happened. Nothing more scary than a man. There's nothing more frightening to a man in his 70s than fading away.
Yeah.
When you know the job's over, nobody wants to hear my shit anymore. I think they latched onto this and their last grasp to hang on to relevancy was I'm not getting the vaccine. And unfortunately for some of them, it's cost them everything.
It has. It's sad. I was going to say, if you want to see some craziness, go on to Amazon, because there are products sold on Amazon that have that ivermectin in it. And if you start reading some of the reviews, you see people asking questions like, how much in this product would be okay for a human to take? Like, people are actually asking these questions because they want to see, can I buy this product and somehow get this, this formula that's in the product inside myself? And I'm just like, this is insanity. It's just
another piece. My wife loves Amazon reviews.
Oh, yeah.
An Amazon review is great if you're buying, I don't know, a juicer. We bought a juicer off Amazon. We read the one that had the right review, had the highest reviews on it.
Right.
You shouldn't take that same approach with
Amazon. No, not something like this.
So, Brandon, just logically, how does something that's a dewormer for animals, because deworming,
it hasn't been used extensively on humans at all or in trials? Yes.
That's some intestinal stuff, right?
Exactly.
So how is me taking this going to prevent me or cure me from a lung infection? Who even thought this up?
Because, last year, starting late summer, early fall last year, there was some speculation that this horse dewormer had some type of anti-inflammatory effect.
Okay.
It was similar to what some of the other steroidal products that they were testing for COVID. Now, they still had no clinical data. They had nothing, but it was just like, oh, we noticed that there's a similarity here. This might be something we can investigate. I think there's been phase one trials that have not been on people, but have just been in labs that have shown that it's not beneficial. But that alone was enough for talk radio to run rampant with it. People on, OANN and Newsmax, because it all feeds into this narrative. Let's just latch on to anything and everything else and just go with that over the vaccine. So that's what's happened. And people, logic has gone out the window, because, again, you can look at the data, and that's why those trials have it gone forward with phase two and phase three, because they proved to not work in phase one.
So Monday of this week, the FDA gave full approval to
the Pfizer vaccine.
I think Moderna's filled their paperwork out.
They will.
Johnson's
not far behind.
A little bit behind him. You've already seen more companies start mandating vaccine.
Delta. Did you see? Yeah.
Yeah. So Delta said, if you don't get it, we're going to surcharge you $200 a month for healthcare.
Now, and I think that could be something you see adopted as well, because there is a strain on the healthcare systems in this country with unvaccinated people that are filling up ICUs. There was actually already a case, and I think it was in Alabama, where a terminally ill cancer patient who ended up dying had to be turned away because there were no beds available because of the COVID explosion at this hospital. Like, that is happening in parts of the country.
There's a famous science fiction book, Fahrenheit 9/11, I think.
451
by Ray Bradbury.
Yep.
And in that book, America's become a dystopian shithole. And basically, the government didn't do it. We did it to ourselves. We created kind of this counter corporate culture. And that's where the rules of society started getting enforced. How do you react to, I don't know if this is intentional, but it sure seems to be benefiting the Biden administration. They are getting big companies to do the work that they don't want to do themselves.
Yeah.
They don't want to come out with a mandate yet, but they know if you get some more of these big companies to do it, you can accomplish that through your corporate partners, not through policy.
Well, it insulates them from the criticism that it's a heavy-handed approach by the government. And you can have conservatives and segments of society that are disdainful and blast it all they want. But at the end of the day, it's private companies dictating this, which is what conservatives have always supported, right? The ability of private companies to set their own policies.
Does this get, does that give you pause in any way to say, like, okay,
that they're kind of offloading it to the companies?
This kind of makes sense. But what's the next thing they're going to try?
I see. Like, where does this go? Like,
where
what's
does
the
this
next?
Go? Yeah. Because a lot of people say, well, the thing that they've also done this to is free speech. I think it fits under the COVID umbrella, but they've also got corporations to do their dirty work in banning people and restricting the amount of information that gets out on COVID. And it's under the umbrella of a public health crisis. But are you, I know as conservatives, you've taken a pretty much a hands-off approach to the market and companies. Do you think there's something that needs to be done, or what's the future of this moving forward?
I mean, that's a good question. So on one hand, we've been doing this for years, right? In areas like healthcare insurance, which has been the prerogative of corporate America.
That's a good point.
And we've basically put that on their shoulders. Obamacare did that as well to a great degree, and getting buy-in as well with big pharma. So this idea that, you know, the government colludes with private enterprise, they've done that throughout time on many different issues. They did that as well kind of on when it's come to many different facets of the airlines and with airline security. So there's part of that that's in our everyday lives. I think the difference as we continue to advance, though, is that we're seeing all this corporate consolidation. So we're seeing fewer and fewer, less and less competition.
Yeah.
And many parts of the marketplace, industries where we have just three or four large companies. And so that's where it becomes more dangerous, right? Because these companies together are almost like a pseudo-government themselves. And if it's the government being able to implement their policy through them, what it means is that you have a couple of big players that make a decision. Everybody else falls in line. It's like a domino effect with the smaller companies because they feel like they have to as far as market share goes. And then we have policy that is dictated by large companies. So I would say it's more of a danger than it is now than it was before, because we don't have, corporate America isn't as fragmented as it used to be.
Very true.
It's consolidated to so much.
Yeah.
Big tech consolidation, pharma consolidation, and it affects every aspect. A good example is the vaccine, right? I mean, Moderna is kind of an anomaly in that they're a tinier company, but Pfizer, large pharma company, J&J, there were many other companies who have effective COVID vaccines that are trying to bring them to market, but they don't have the financial resources that the big guys have.
Yeah.
So they haven't benefited from being first to market. So we see a scenario now where it's the big guys now that are going to reap the benefits, and those that didn't have the financial backing, you know, they are going to get vaccine effectiveness, you know, eventually over the finish line, but they're not going to have the backing of the government. They're not going to have a space. They're not going to have the market share. So that, I think that's where the danger lies.
I'd like to see somebody make a vaccination commercial that basically says, if you're 50 years old and you're unvaccinated, your odds of getting the Delta variant are X.
Yeah.
And if you get the Delta variant, your odds of going to the hospital are Y. Now, you're probably not going to die. Let's run through what the bill is you're going to leave with the hospital.
Yeah.
Let's say that will
change minds.
Let's say you just have standard insurance. You've got to be walking out of there with tens and thousands of dollars.
Oh, yeah.
Do you want to ruin yourself or increase the odds of ruining yourself financially simply because you won't get this vaccine?
Right.
I think there's a practical message to appeal to people. Just keep yourself out of the hospital. Keep yourself out from paying a giant bill that you just don't need, or you don't have to have if you get a vaccine.
Well, I do think ultimately insurance carriers, I think saying that you're going to have to pay higher policy prices or premiums, or they're not going to cover you if you're not, like, that is going to move the needle.
Is what's next?
Everybody, I mean, you're right.
Everybody gets on a scale, and if you're too fat, we charge you for that.
Do you
have to start filling out a form of all of your personal vices that we now put a formula together and say, we're going to upcharge you $50 because you drank too much and you smoke? Is that, where does this stop?
Where does it end? Yeah.
I understand what they're trying to do to offer the incentive, but that feels a bit too much manipulation at that point.
Yeah, and that has been brought up by others too. Like, where do you draw the line? You know, when it comes to other controllable factors that people, yeah, you know, choose to engage in that undermines their health.
Let's end with, we're coming up on our hour. Tuesday is, I'm assuming, still going to be the withdrawal from, yeah, Afghanistan. Tell me what Tuesday looks like. What happens on Tuesday?
Well, you know, I don't know. I think probably an effective and outcome would be that there isn't much in the way of news. There may be some last kind of final evacuations that occur. You know, it's not going to be tumultuous. It's not going to be chaotic. We just kind of roll out of there and leave. That would ultimately be the best outcome, where there's no news, right? If we see a lot of news, that's going to probably not be good. That's probably going to indicate, you know, God forbid that there'd be some type of another terrorist incident that would, you know, I think be timed with our complete exit, something like that. That would be bad news. So I think good outcome is that it's quiet, last remaining people are evacuated out, we leave, and that's it. And yeah, that, you know, there aren't any like emotional, you know, photos like what we saw when
just
Kabul
iconic
fell.
Moments of
no,
we, the last
nothing
flag,
like that.
You
know. Yeah.
Now take me a year ahead. It's August 31st, 2022. What's the 10,000 foot view of Afghanistan in a year?
Well, I think Afghanistan could look very much like it did in, you know, 1995, yeah, 1996. But, you know, as the Taliban was, you know, gaining control, there's, you know, it's going to probably revert back, as much as the Taliban, you know, does these overtures where they say they want to be modern and give everybody a chance.
Do you put any stock into any of that?
I don't, because if you look at what they've already done, like they've sent home women who are teachers from the, yeah, schools and from like news stations and banks saying you can't work anymore, you need to find a male counterpart to do your job. Yeah. Like they've already started all that. I mean, I don't believe that girls are going to be able to be educated anymore. So it's going to revert back to where it was in 1996. It'll be like rolling back the clock, essentially. So that is going to happen. I still think there's going to be, you know, a civil war, because there's going to be pockets of the country that are resistant to the Taliban, but aren't in complete control. So there's going to be fighting that's happening in, yeah, various places, outlying provinces. And it's, you know, it's going to be a nomadic kind of closed state like it was. Because when people forget, when the Taliban was in power, it was very similar to like North Korea. It was a closed state. There was a lot of access by outside media, yeah, no Western media. You know, it was one of those places that was intriguing because we didn't know what was happening. And what was happening was very gruesome and dark. Yeah. So I don't have a lot of hope at all for the future of the country based on what we know about the Taliban.
Do you think in the next 5 years there's a terrorist attack on American soil that emanates from Afghanistan?
There could be. And I think I'm fearful of that for a number of reasons. Number one, you have Pakistan next door, which has been arming and helping the Taliban. They are going to be coordinating. And Pakistan is a nuclear power. People forget that's where Osama bin Laden was hiding out, was in Pakistan. Yeah. They've provided refuge for Al-Qaeda and ISIS, and have been the Taliban's support arm during the last 20 years. So I think that Pakistan will assist and funnel in weapons and military equipment, yeah, to ISIS and Al-Qaeda. And I think that, I mean, I think not only is it very likely there'd be a terrorist attack, I do think it's also likely that we may see China come in and offer to provide infrastructure support with the Taliban and say, hey, we will help you. And so China will become an ally and a partner in Afghanistan. The country isn't going to be better off, but China will be.
They said the two safest spots in Kabul right now are the Chinese and Russian embassy.
Yeah.
There's no activity at those places. Let's end with, so my wife has just started watching mindless trash on Netflix, which I don't mind, but they're so bad. Have you ever watched or heard of Virgin River?
I've heard of the show. I saw promos for it on Netflix. It didn't seem like something I would like. So
what I don't understand is all of these cast are like big mashups of people that have been on Law and Order episodes. Because, you know, there's Law and Order, there's Law and Order SUV, there's Law and Order Criminal Intent. Like the entire cast, you can piece together things you've seen them before. And there's no real plot. It's just good looking people doing activities that look nice. It's I don't know why she's been on such a trash TV run lately, but because before that we watched Outer Banks. Have you investigated the Outer Banks?
No, I need to. So it's next on my list, and several people have promoted Outer Banks as well. But I mean, your review assessment of it was kind of mixed. You weren't.
Oh, it's horrible, but in all the right ways.
Okay,
let's put it this way: these kids allegedly are all in high school, but the actors are all in their 30s, and they do things like they find a boat and go to the Bahamas just because high school kids know how to drive a boat from North Carolina to the Bahamas. Right. What I love about the Outer Banks, so most television shows are linear. You know, there's characters, there's developed, there's a story arc, there's action, there's a peak, there's a resolution, there's an end.
Yeah.
The Outer Banks does none of that. The Outer Banks has cracked the code because they take a quantum approach to it. Nothing's linear. Everything happens at once. So there are eight different storylines all progressing. Some just die out and you don't hear from them again. Some interact. I can't describe the show to you. You just have to watch it, and you'll either love the insanity or you'll be like, this is the dumbest thing I've ever seen.
I've been watching Ted Lasso, which drops one episode a week.
They've gotten back on their groove a little
bit. They have, yeah. And I don't want to give any spoilers, but yeah, this week's episode wanting to know what happens right away with the next episode. And then I've started into Nine Perfect Strangers, which is on Hulu.
Is that good?
It's pretty good. Yeah. It has Nicole Kidman, Melissa McCarthy. A good cast. It's basically centers around the group of strangers that all have underlying issues they're dealing with, whether it's depression or anxiety. And they all converge upon this wellness spa that's in the middle of the desert. So think about some of these kind of iffy,
culty-ish
wellness spas that have been the news from time to time because they either, you know, require mass starvation or they take like very kind aggressive like
soul
methods.
Cycle, right? To get you into.
There's
the
been a few leaders
mood.
Of some of these who have been prosecuted for some of their tactics. So that kind of mindset, and so you have the leader of this spa, who's Nicole Kidman, and very mysterious. And these people, they think that this is going to be like a kind of normal retreat where it's like, oh, we're going to have yoga and all these activities and lunch. And then they quickly realize like they're being denied food, like all these. And then there's a lot of like illegal things happening. It's one of those I don't want to give a lot away, but they're under false pretenses. They think they're there to get over their internal demons. And the head of the spa, Nicole Kidman's character who invited them, she has ulterior motives and ulterior designs on them. And so it then quickly unravels. So it's a kind of a mystery thriller series. Without saying a whole lot more, it is really good so far. So it's kind of intriguing, kind of curious to see where it goes. Like one of the guys who's there is like a washed up football star who has a lot of regret for his career falling apart. Like he suffered like a concussion and then he accidentally killed a guy inside of a bar who was attacking him, and he was just defending himself, but he still feels this immense guilt over it. Like they all have their own, like there's a family there that has the son committed suicide, so they're trying to get over his death, and the sister. So there's all these like interwoven stories, and they bring all this baggage with them. And then you have that on top of the fact that they're finding out that this is not just a wellness retreat, it's more like a prison. It's an intriguing story. Yeah.
And Nicole Kidman can get super creepy.
She can. And she plays like, her character is Russian in this. I've never seen her with a Russian accent. And it's like, she does it very well. Her name's like Masha. She's like this creepy Russian woman, diabolical.
So I stumbled into this anime series on Netflix called Beastar.
Oh, okay.
So I can't even explain it because it's too weird. It's too sexual. And it's all anime, and the characters are animals. So picture
sexual with animals.
See, even if I try to explain this, I sound like a complete weirdo. Basically, society is split between carnivores and herbivores. And it's about the power dynamic between people who have power and people that don't. And then
who has power? The carnivores?
The carnivores do.
Okay, that makes sense.
They have to restrain themselves to get along, to have any type of functioning society.
Okay.
They can't just go around killing everybody. But of course, there's black markets they go to. And there's a sexual dynamic that is, again, I'm not even going to attempt to explain this, but it has to do with power, too.
Yeah.
It, again, it's... It's done in anime.
Yeah.
The characters are all animals. If you can get past that a little bit and get into the story, it's very complex. It's very interesting. It's also very weird and not going to be everybody's cup of tea. Yeah. If you don't like animals doing like sexual stuff.
That's
like
not your thing. Yeah.
That you may be turned off by this pretty quickly.
Okay.
But it is pretty interesting.
Yeah. It sounds different. Yeah, it's kind of compelling.
Different is definitely a term. Yeah. If it's good, just depends, I think, on your the viewer own. At that point.
So I will end this by saying I just saw a movie recently. I haven't been too impressed with the horror movies that have been out, but I saw The Night House in theaters. I don't know if you've seen the trailers for that. So just kind of quick summary. It's about a widow, recent widow, whose husband of 14 years, she's a high school teacher. He just committed suicide. And so she's grieving over that and trying to figure out why. And she's living in the lake house that he built for them. And then she starts to notice weird things happening, haunting happening. Yeah. It takes a completely different turn. There's a lot of good jump scares, which are always good, like legitimate, like unsuspecting jump scares. The movie plays with you because there's times you think there's going to be a jump scare and it doesn't happen. Then it happens when you least suspect it. But then the entire story arc, I mean, from what you're expecting, completely goes in a different direction. And it's one of these meta horror movies. It leaves a lot up to interpretation at the end. And sometimes I get frustrated with those movies, but in this case, it was a good thing. Like, it was one of those movies I was thinking about in my head and talking about for, I think, days after I saw it, because it was so good. And you're wondering, well, did this mean this? Like, I feel like I have to see that again now, because I think I missed something in this scene. So very good. It's not just one of your traditional, like, cookie cutter horror movies where it's just like, okay, I've seen that 1,000 times.
Yeah.
This one's very different, takes a completely different turn. There's a lot of psychological aspect of it that doesn't fall into the traditional, like, haunted, you know, house theme where you're like, okay, maybe there's a lot that's going on internally that is also happening simultaneously. Very good movie. First good horror movie I've seen in a while.
I stumbled into this podcast called Blank Check, and it's two movie nerds. And the premise is they're directors that very young in their career are very successful. And then they're given a blank check to make whatever films they want. Okay. M. Night Shyamalan is the best example of this. Comes out with The Sixth Sense. He's young. He's going to be the next great director. He gets to make whatever he wants.
Yeah.
Sometimes he makes okay.
And sometimes
he makes just absolute shit. It's called Blank Check. You might enjoy it.
I'm going to check that out. I would like that.
They do it by director. They'll take a director and they'll walk down all of his movies, the genre, you know, where his blank checks paid
blank
off,
check. I'm gonna have to,
where it fell apart. If you're into movies, it's really, really interesting. And what's that? There's a movie where I think it's based in a record store, but you know, people who are like really, really into movies get a little arrogant about it.
Oh yeah.
You know, that's these two to a T, but it's done funny. It's a pretty good pun.
Well, that's awesome. I'll have to check it out. I just learned that the guy that plays Roy Kent and Ted Lasso,
I love that guy.
Which I love his character, by the way, but his name's like Goldstein, something Goldstein. So he has his own movie podcast as well.
That could
be
good.
Where he just talks movies with guest stars. Some of them are famous, semi-celebrities, celebrities, some are not. And I have to look up the name of the podcast, but just like what he considers kind of like the best movies throughout time.
I like Roy Kent's character because Roy Kent is normalizing, again, men with thick, luscious chest hair. The first thing in those scenes when he comes out, that's the first thing you notice about him, is that actor is a man that has a full palette of chest hair that he displays without apology. And I find that to be, that's just part of a good, funny part of his.
It is. Yeah. It's a part of his shtick. And then also, like, he's just kind of grumpy, like his actual personality and demeanor kind of grows on you, that his, you know, the grunting all the time.
He's and
just
brutally honest, though.
Yes.
If there's something that needs to be said, Roy Kent is going.
He'll be there to say it. Yep.
Yeah. Ted Lasso has found his groove back. If for some reason you're holding out watching Ted Lasso, just don't. Just dive in and do it. It's a great show.
It is.
All right. That's our hour. Thanks, Brandon.
Thanks, Craig.
Thanks for listening to 2 Men in the Middle. Make sure to give us a 5-star review wherever you get your podcasts. Check out our website at 2meninthemiddle.com. Drop us an email at 2meninthemiddle@gmail.com or tweet at us at 2meninthemiddle. We'll see you next week.